Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Bycatch is one of the primary anthropogenic stressors that we can control.
Federal fisheries managers are considering chum salmon bycatch limits. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, April 7th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, the Anchorage Assembly seems likely to approve Mayor Dave Bronson's 4th pick for municipal attorney.
I have no agenda. I have no alliances. I am here to provide the best possible legal representation for the entire city.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health, but did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by Snap.
More people moved out of Alaska than into the state last year, but other population factors nearly offset the loss, according to new figures from the U.S. Census Bureau. Christy Wilder, a census demographer, says Alaska lost more than 6,000 people to other states, continuing a decade-long trend.
2010 was the last time that Alaska had positive net domestic migration.
But Wilder says the population loss to domestic migration was almost entirely offset by two other dynamics. Births outnumbered deaths, and more than 2,000 people moved to Alaska from other countries. In all, the state's population held nearly steady at 734,000. According to the Census Bureau, that's a loss of fewer than 600 residents. Within Alaska, Wilder says the action was largely in South Central.
I hope I don't butcher this name, but Matanuska Borough was the largest gaining in 2022, and Anchorage had the highest loss in population.
The Matanuska-Susitna Borough gained more than 2,000 residents, while Anchorage lost nearly 1,600, according to the Census Bureau's estimates. The State Department of Labor also tracks population. The numbers it released in January largely tracked the federal agencies, though it found the state population rose slightly last year, up 400 residents. The Department of Labor also noted a significant decline in working-age Alaskans. When more people were moving to Alaska than leaving, adults in their 20s and 30s were the main source of the state's population gain, but in the past decade, according to the state, more people in that age group are leaving than arriving. Meanwhile, since chum salmon runs collapsed in 2020, subsistence fishing along the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers has been almost non-existent. Pro-subsistence advocates have long called for tighter salmon bycatch limits for Bering Sea pollock trawlers, and for the first time this week, that effort moved a small step forward. Alaska Public Media's Kavitha George reports.
The disappearance of chum and Chinook salmon from western Alaska has devastated indigenous communities along the Yukon and Kuskokwim, the two major river systems in the region. Tom Kriska lives in the Yukon village of Nulato. He testified at a North Pacific Fisheries Management Council advisory panel meeting on Thursday.
We don't have the fish. Our kids are not learning anything. Bears are coming in to our areas. There's a lot of things that are affecting our way of life right now, and seems like no one cares.
The cause of the salmon collapse is a contentious issue. Scientists say climate change, warming rivers and oceans, is likely at play. Many pro-subsistence advocates also blame pollock trawlers for intercepting salmon traveling inland from the Bering Sea. Right now, there are bycatch limits for Chinook salmon, but not chum. That could change. On Friday, the advisory panel voted to advance a series of recommendations, some of which would limit chum bycatch, to the Maine Council for consideration. This is the first time Western Alaska chum bycatch limits have come before the council. Trawlers argue that a bycatch limit won't change the situation much. In the last two decades, only about 10% of chum intercepted in the Bering Sea were headed for Western Alaska, according to genetic studies. Megan Williams, a fishery scientist for the Ocean Conservancy, argued at the meeting that while bycatch may not be the only driver of the Chum collapse, every fish accidentally caught at sea is one that doesn't make it to communities upriver.
I fully appreciate that research suggests there are multiple stressors driving reduced salmon survival, reduced chum survival and productivity, many of which are likely to be exacerbated by climate change. But I'll repeat this message over and over again. don't want to be redundant, but bycatch is one of the primary anthropogenic stressors that we can control.
Testimony on Thursday mostly favored bycatch limits. Many Indigenous and environmental advocates argued that the limits are necessary to protect food security and culture in the region, which is going on 3 years with no subsistence fishing. The trawl pollock season runs from January to October, but it peaks during the summer. The vast majority of salmon bycatch also happens in summer when salmon migrate toward their river spawning grounds. Last year, pollock trawlers scooped up almost 250,000 chum salmon. About a quarter of those were headed for western Alaska or the upper Yukon. Brent Payne, executive director of Seattle-based United Catcher Boats, argued against one proposal to close the trawl pollock fishery during peak chum migration in July and August.
It's so costly to shut a plant and a fleet down and just say, we're going to start you back up again. If we can find a better mousetrap, I guess, if we can find a way to avoid western Alaska chum when we know they're moving through, but don't use a blunt tool if you can use something more surgical.
It's now up to the Management Council to decide how to move forward with several options outlining various degrees of bycatch limitation. Federal management tends to move slowly, so it's unlikely any new regulation will be in place for this summer. Run forecasts for Western Alaska chum and Chinook for the upcoming season remain pessimistic. In Anchorage, I'm Kavitha George.
Two conservation groups are suing the Environmental Protection Agency over its alleged failure to finalize standards to protect U.S. waterways from harmful vessel discharges, including cruise ships. In a complaint filed in February, Friends of the Earth and the Center for Biological Diversity say that the 2018 Vessel Incidental Discharge Act required the EPA to develop standards for discharges from ships. The lawsuit seeks an injunction that would require the EPA to issue those rules. Much of the lawsuit focuses on the ballast water that ships take on to provide stability. Friends of the Earth Oceans and Vessels Program Director Marcy Kiever says that when ships take on water in one place and discharge it in another, that can help spread invasive species and diseases.
Unless you have treatment to a level with which gets rid of these invasive species, when your ship exchanges ballast water, it's an incredible risk, just from invasive species alone, let alone the pathogens you might encounter from ships coming from all over the world into our waters.
An EPA spokesperson declined to comment on the pending litigation. In their lawsuit, the conservation groups say invasive species alone cause more than $9 billion in damage each year to infrastructure for public water supplies, industry, and power plants. But ballast water is only one focus of the lawsuit. Kiever says the groups are also concerned about discharges from scrubbers that reduce ships' air pollution.
The biggest rise in wastewater pollution that we've seen over the last several years is exhaust gas scrubber wastewater, which is, basically the wastewater generated when you use a wet scrubber to scrub your smokestack to comply with international rules for cleaner fuel.
A Coast Alaska investigation published last year uncovered dozens of reports from independent cruise ship monitors alerting state authorities to foamy discharges from ships operated by Carnival Corporation and subsidiaries like Holland America and Princess. Kiever says those discharges can harm marine life and those that depend on it for sustenance.
So essentially what they've done is converted air pollution into water pollution.
Lawyers for the conservation groups and the EPA are due to appear before U.S. District Judge William Orrick in the Northern District of California in mid-May. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, hunters with disabilities say harvesting moose in an Anchorage park can be done safely.
I have spent 9 years working on this, and there's a lot of concerns with hunting in a city park. There's a lot of people there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station.
The Anchorage Assembly today suspended the municipality's sister city relationship with Magadan in Russia's Far East in protest of Russia's unprovoked war in Ukraine. The action comes more than a year after Russia invaded Ukraine, and Governor Mike Dunleavy called on Alaska cities to cut these ties. The Anchorage Sister City Commission recommended the suspension. Assemblymember Daniel Voland pushed for the resolution to suspend the relationship.
I have been asked by constituents, why are we flying the Russian flag for municipal property when Russia has been accused of war crimes? And while Anchorage is welcoming Ukrainian refugees fleeing their war-torn homeland, what political message does that send to them?
The resolution passed in a 10-0 vote. Assembly members emphasized that this is a suspension, not a permanent breakup. They intend to reinstate the relationship at some point after hostilities have ended. They also noted the action is a reaction to the Russian government and military, not the people of Magadan. Meanwhile, attorney Ann Helzer was appointed to lead the municipality of Anchorage's legal department in February as it juggled multiple high-profile legal fights from the Anchorage Assembly and former employees. On Thursday, she was well-received at an Assembly confirmation hearing ahead of a confirmation vote scheduled for Tuesday. Helzer is Mayor Dave Bronson's fourth pick for the position in a cabinet that's had an alarming amount of turnover since his tenure began in 2021. For example, he's on his fifth chief of staff, third library director, third health department director, and second municipal manager. Several executives in these roles remain unconfirmed. Members asked Helzer how she saw her role, given the friction between the assembly and the mayor. Helzer said she was well aware of the tension. She also made a promise.
I commit to you, the assembly, that it's my understanding that I represent the entire city of Anchorage and the assembly and the administration. I have no agenda. I have no alliances. I am here to provide the best possible legal representation for the entire city, and that certainly includes the assembly.
Assemblymember Austin Quinn Davidson, who is also an attorney, asked Helzer why she would forgo other career opportunities for this one, especially with allegations of illegal and unethical behavior in the mayor's office.
Either I could stand and continue to watch all the things that were in the news, or I could decide to do something about it.
Helzer, a former president of the Anchorage Bar Association, said she will be a fair, reasonable, ethical, and caring attorney for the city. The municipal attorney's office has an annual operating budget of about $8.6 million with 46 full-time employees. Satellite imagery of the Arctic has advanced dramatically over the last 20 years, making it possible to ask new questions about how climate change is impacting the far north. With permafrost thaw outpacing previous projections, a Homer-based researcher is helping bring the issue into high resolution. KBBI's Sean McDermott reports.
After growing up in Sweden, Anna Liljedahl moved to Alaska to study Arctic hydrology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She now lives in Homer, where she conducts research as an associate scientist at the Woodwell Climate Research Center, focusing on how climate change is impacting water in Arctic ecosystems.
It's something that's already an issue, and it's not being given the attention it deserves.
Liljedahl is now leading a team to create more accurate, interactive maps of Alaska's permafrost. Their project, called the Permafrost Discovery Gateway, is a pioneering effort to make Arctic research quicker to share and easier to access. That's critical as the climate crisis accelerates permafrost thaw, impacting Alaskan communities and global carbon and methane emissions.
Changes are happening so fast that we need to come up with automated ways of tracking this permafrost thaw through remote sensing imagery, and also really make some tools, automated tools, that help us identify where change is happening.
Permafrost is ground that remains frozen for at least two consecutive years, though some of it has been frozen for thousands of years. Scientists estimate that more than 80% of Alaska has permafrost. In some places, like the North Slope, it stretches continuously across the entire region, where it can be 2,000 feet thick. The actual ice content of permafrost also varies. The Permafrost Discovery Gateway provides a new level of detail and scale to mapping the Arctic.
So we had to create our own software, our own visualization tool, where you can view this really, really big map at the Panarctic scale and at the same time zoom in and look at what's happening in your backyard.
Elizabeth Webb is a researcher at the University of Florida who has shared research on the Permafrost Discovery Gateway database. She's been studying the connection between vanishing surface water and permafrost thaw. She says previous models projected thawing would initially increase water in lakes and then decrease later this century with more sustained warming. But that's not how things seem to be playing out.
You would think more rain would mean more water, but actually more rain means more permafrost thaw, which means more drainage.
This can be a big issue for Arctic communities, Webb says. Not only can permafrost thaw damage homes and infrastructure like pipes, it can also impact the availability of reliable drinking water as lakes shrink or drain completely.
It's not like all the lakes are going to drain and then suddenly there's not going to be any water left for them. But it does mean that these communities are now more vulnerable.
Researchers across the state are working hard to better understand these intricacies and the unique Alaskan landscapes permafrost has created. On a recent virtual tour of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers permafrost tunnel in Fairbanks Goldstream Valley, senior scientist Tom Douglas welcomed more than 500 viewers from across the country on a journey back through time. Getting field data from different areas around the state is still a huge challenge, so having researchers be able to take samples and study permafrost features in the tunnel is incredibly valuable.
We really need any type of information possible and ways to basically accumulate, synthesize, and display that information. And that's why the Permafrost Discovery Gateway is just largely needed and very cool project.
You can take a digital stroll back through thousands of years of geology on a virtual tour of the permafrost tunnel outside of Fairbanks and explore the growing database of permafrost research by searching Permafrost Discovery Gateway. In Homer, I'm Sean McDermott.
Pacific Northwest ports and major cruise lines are teaming up to examine how to reduce the carbon footprint of the Alaska cruise circuit. The cruise lines are beginning to test different fueling options, everything from hydrogen to methanol, biodiesel, and LNG, or liquefied natural gas. However, none of those are available in sufficient volume at ports like Seattle, Vancouver, BC, and Juneau. Jessica John is a vice president at Norwegian Cruise Line.
And when we talk to fuel producers, what we hear all the time is not that they're not willing to invest, but they need to know that there is demand, right, before they know where to head in terms of their investment. And then when you talk to the customers, they say the same thing. Well, we can't make a decision because we need to know where the fuel supply is going to be for us to make a commitment.
John spoke during a webinar Thursday convened to rally so-called first movers to back a cruise industry-led Pacific Northwest to Alaska Green Corridor. The group's next step is a feasibility plan focused on ship fuel options and adding more shore power plug-ins.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you love what you hear on your public radio station, consider becoming a member. Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. Find out how you can include a gift to your public radio station through estate planning. Ask your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more.
One of Anchorage's biggest and most heavily used city parks could see a limited annual moose hunt for hunters with disabilities. That's after the State Board of Game approved a plan last month that would allow the closure of parts of Kincaid Park for hunters with mobility issues to harvest antlerless moose or by bow or shotgun. The earliest a hunt could happen would be October 2024, and it still needs city approval. Those who've spoken out against the idea say it would pose a safety risk to other park users, and they question whether hunting is an appropriate use of the park. Ira Edwards wrote the proposal and says his plan addresses those concerns. He's a hunter and outdoor enthusiast who uses a wheelchair. Edwards told Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove that the hunt would provide a much-needed opportunity for hunters like himself, and it would also thin out the moose in Kincaid, where run-ins between humans and moose are common.
So accessibility is a huge issue for people with disabilities and mobility impairments. Kincaid is nice in that the city and the Nordic Ski Club have built huge trail networks all over the park, and they're all hardened for heavy machinery use. So all the trails are built to withstand heavy use by the bike community, the running people, and everyone, dog walkers. And that means that there's also a way to drive a vehicle on the trails and get easy access to all areas of the park, which is something that is not really feasible in much of Alaska.
So what would this look like? I mean, what kind of, you know, bows or firearms be allowed? What part of the park would it happen in? And like, what time of year do we know?
So I have spent 9 years working on this, and there's a lot of concerns with hunting in a city park. There's a lot of people there. So just to address some of that, only a portion of the park could be closed. No part of the park is closed for an entire week, and people are really concerned about lack of access to the park. And also, there's a series of trails that I've figured out that would have the least amount of barricades necessary to let everyone know that there is an active hunt happening in Area X. So this would be a hunt that would happen during the weekday when there is still use in the park, but less organized events. It would happen after the high school and middle school cross-country running season starts and before the high school ski season starts. So it would happen mid-October is generally the plan. And then during the daylight hours only. And then example for what is legally allowed, the Board of Game changed my proposal a little bit, but they are allowing for people with physical disabilities only, requiring a wheelchair or mobility devices such as prosthetics. It would be a shotgun with slugs, which are short range, lower velocity. It would be archery, or it would be crossbow.
But that part about the safety of other folks, other park users potentially wandering into the hunt area, just unaware that's going on, how do you deal with that?
And that's a part of it. That's why we would have barricades and signs at access points. So yes, it's possible people could be walking through the woods. I would imagine that 99% of the people are on trails. So there's no way they could pass a trail and not notice that there is going to be a potentially closed area ahead of them. And then at the trailheads, we would also mark that too. So if somehow they missed it, they could not have gotten onto the trails if they drove into a trailhead and found that also. Yeah, there's a lot of social trails in there, but Kincaid is pretty easy as that it's bordered by Raspberry Road, and then there is the coastal trail. There's the Anchorage Coastal Wildlife Refuge, which does allow hunting on it currently if you have a permit and hunter's education. So people could wander in off the mud flats as well. But all those access points where they come into a trail would also be notified.
And just one other thing. I mean, I guess one of the criticisms I had read about was some folks, you know, kind of debating whether or not Kincaid is the type of park that, you know, we should look to think about recreational opportunities in the form of hunting in this case, and sort of getting a resource out of it, or if it should be the kind of park where we let the wildlife sit over there and we just look at it. And I just wonder what do you think about that kind of debate?
That's a valid concern. If you want to tell someone where to go see a moose, you tell them to go to Kincaid. I am proposing this to be an antlerless hunt only for two reasons. The bulls, while they might get aggressive during the rut, they haven't actually hurt anyone. I know a few dogs have been hurt over the years, but the injuries from moose have happened with cows defending their calves in the spring, which is a real thing. I mean, you come and surprise a mama with her babies and they're going to get mad. But the density of trails in the Kincaid Park is what has caused that. And that's why Kincaid is not zoned for wildlife viewing like Bicentennial Park is. And that's written into Muni Code on the parks that, like I said, Kincaid is a highly developed recreational facility.
That was Ira Edwards, who has proposed a moose hunt for disabled hunters in Anchorage's Kincaid Park, speaking with Alaska Public Media's Casey Grove. Appayuk Raytan is the first openly trans musher to run the Iditarod. Her documentary about the experience had its Alaska debut in Juneau last Friday night. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
The film has a solitary vibe. It shows Appayuk Raytan preparing for the race and her send-off in Anchorage, with a large trans pride flag flying from her sled.
Go! Appayuk Raytan from Katovic, on her way to Nome.
Then it turns inward, mostly showing her speaking into the camera as she races through wide open landscapes. When she's just over 100 miles from the finish in Nome, she yells she's excited to see her dad.
He's kind of the reason why I'm able to do this, by him supporting my dog machine. And he's also very supportive of being trans.
The mood at the screening is defiant. It's Transgender Day of Visibility, and earlier in the day, someone posted anti-trans signs in public places around Juneau. And the day before, Raytan had joined many other Alaskans in testifying against Governor Mike Dunleavy's parental rights bill. Among other things, the legislation would require parental permission for Alaska students to take sex ed or to use different names and pronouns in schools. It would even apply to students who want to go to clubs that support LGBTQ+ identities.
We were never presented as human beings. I never saw girls like me. By the time I was realizing I'm trans, by researching online, I had already gone through a testosterone puberty, which I wish I would have learned about trans people before that happened.
Raytan grew up in Norway and Alaska, and she's been mushing since she was 4 years old. That's how old she was when she first knew she was a girl. She learned the sport from her father, and she completed the Iditarod back in 2019 before coming out as transgender. She said she's happy with the response her film has gotten from other trans people so far, and she hopes to increase the representation of trans women that younger people can see themselves in.
We're also, like, being talked about all the time. So it's... our existence is, like, undeniable. But I think all of the legislative attacks on us is going to end.
In the meantime, Raytan hopes that trans kids can hang on if they live in a state or a family situation where it feels impossible to come out.
If you can make it to adulthood, then you can transition later and you can be okay. And it's gone well for a lot of us.
The documentary that shows just how well it's gone for Raytan isn't available online yet. It's still making the film festival circuits. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Kavitha George, Casey Grove, and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Eric Stone in Ketchikan, Sean McDermott in Homer, Tom Bonsi in Nakata, Washington, and Yvonne Crumry in Juneau. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Wesley Early. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation. Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.